was on the last lecture. We started to talk about particles. And so for a system of arbitrary number of particles, we introduced operators that create and annihilate these particles. Which are be commutation or anti-commutation relations, depending on whether particles are bosons and fermions, so that A commutes or anti-commutes with AP commutes or anti-commutes with AQ, and so do their conjugates. But the operators themselves, so AP with AQ dagger, anti-commutes on the delta function. So let me, with the 2 pi. Yeah, thank you. And then by Fourier transforming these operators in the coordinate space, we got the field operators. Psi of x, psi dagger of x, which satisfy similar commutation or anti-commutation relations, so that the operators commute or anti-commute with each other. And commute or anti-commute with their conjugates on the delta function. So this is the first example of a quantum field. So it's an operator that depends on some position in space. And we can write the expression for the Hamiltonian or any other operator for the system in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So in particular, for the Hamiltonian, we found that it's equal to the integral of h squared over 2m, and then gradient of psi dagger dot gradient of psi plus 1/2 integral dx dy u of x minus y, and then times psi dagger x, psi dagger y, psi x, psi y. So this term describes free particles. And this term is responsible for interactions. Notice that in the Hamiltonian, these terms are distinguished by the number of field operators. So the term that describes free particles contains is quadratic in psi, and the interaction term is quartic in the fields. So this is the important point to notice. Yes? Here, I think we defined them such that there is no H bar. Let me check. Well, it depends on the definition, of course. You can rescale them such that H bar appears, but we define them such that they commute on one, already commute. Okay, so this representation of many body quantum mechanics is called second quantization. So the, in some sense, these psis are counterparts of single particle wave function, psi, which is a C number. It's a numerical function. And then if you make, promote this function to an operator, then this is a way to describe multiparticle dynamics. So usually, in what we will do, in what follows, we will start with some expression like that. So we will, Hamiltonian will be a function of fields, a functional fields that satisfy certain computation relations. And then we would, so Fourier transforming the fields, we will get a set of creation and annihilation operators. So that satisfies these commutation relations. And from these commutation relations, it immediately follows that the spectrum is described by particles. So the we can denote the state that's annihilated by all annihilation operators. So call this an empty state. And then we can build all other states by applying creation operator. So state with n particles will then be given by application of creation operators to the empty state n times. So this, the collection of the states with arbitrary number of particles is called Fock space. And all our operators act in this space, so field operators also act in the Fock space, and Hamiltonian acts in the Fock space. And so in principle, the problem that one wants to solve is to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, which in general is not possible to do except in some particular cases. For instance, when this U is the delta function, and the system is one-dimensional, then this problem is solvable exactly by a method called beta ansatz. But this is a very exceptional case. Typically, what one does is one can solve the problem perturbatively. So if interactions are weak, we can expand in the interactions. And then there one can develop perturbation theory starting from this Hamiltonian. Or there are some other tricks one can do, like in field theory, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, what we'll be talking about later will apply also to this Hamiltonian. So we will develop perturbative method to calculate, in principle, anything in quantum field theory, in the case where the interactions are small. The method is called Feynman diagrams, and it's quite generic, so it will apply also to this Hamiltonian. Anyway, so next we started to discuss the quantization of sound waves or vibrations of an atomic chain. And after some approximations, we obtained the Hamiltonian that looks like that. So this describes vibrations of atomic chain which are with small amplitude. And with large wavelengths. So we made certain approximations when we derived this formula. We assumed that the displacement of an atom from its equilibrium position, which is basically u, is small compared to the distance between atoms. And also that this displacement depends on the position along this the atomic chain sufficiently slowly, so that we can make a continuous approximation and describe these vibrations by continuous sound waves. So the equations that follow from this Hamiltonian just the equations of motion for p and u reduce to the wave equation when we exclude p. So this is the wave equation, and it describes sound waves. So the constant that appears here, it was some combination of the mass of the atoms and the lattice spacing and the potential of interaction between them. The meaning of this quantity is that this is the speed of sound. Now, what we want to do is we want to quantize this equation. So we start with this Hamiltonian. We know that p and u are canonical variables. So that u of x with p of y is equal to I h bar delta of x minus y. And then starting from this commutation relation and the Hamiltonian, we want to diagonalize it. So this is done as follows. We introduce operators A and A dagger, which are essentially Fourier transforms of U and P. So morally speaking, what we do is we repeat the same steps as here, but backwards. So we know the fields, and then we want to find out the oscillator operators. So the expressions are the following. I will not give derivation, just the final answer. By the way, can everyone see my handwriting? Should I write bigger letters or is it okay? So here. So these are basically linear combinations of the Fourier transforms of U and P. And the important property of these operators is that they satisfy the oscillator commutation relations. So AK with A dagger Q is equal to 2 pi h bar delta of k minus p, k minus q. And they commute with each other. So a with k with another a with q commute. So we reduce the problem to the same problem with which we started here. So we can now define the empty state, which is annihilated by all of A's, and then build up the whole Fock space by applying A daggers. So the space of states in this problem is the same as the Fock space of some bosonic particles. So these particles are called phonons. And their quanta of the sound waves. So quantization of sound waves has led us to some sort of particles, which are not real particles. The underlying physics is that of atoms that vibrate around their equilibrium positions. But effectively, we can think of the system as system of sort of new particles or emergent particles that are phonons, and describe the physics just in terms of them. So they are, in a sense, they're not real particles, but it is convenient to think of, of crystalline solids as, thermal reservoirs of phonons. And so this gives the convenient description of many things in solid state physics. So the way it worked is rather interesting because we started with a system that had very strong interactions. So the atoms were interacting with each other rather strong forces that didn't allow them to move very far away from the equilibrium. So we made this assumption that forces are very strong. Then we did some approximations, and at the end we arrived at the equations that describe, again, particles, but very weakly interacting. So in fact, this Hamiltonian describes just three phonons. You see that it's quadratic in P and U. And the energy is just the sum of energies of individual phonons, which we shortly see. But anyway, so we started with a very strongly interacting system. And then we changed variables to, so introduced, in some sense, new degrees of freedom that are important at low energies. And in terms of this new degrees of freedom, the system is weakly interacting. So this is this way of thinking about field theory is quite universal. So in many cases, field theories are effective. So they describe some low energy degrees of freedom, which are to some extent insensitive to the original strongly coupled dynamics. So the physics at, like here, so physics at very short scales, so at distances of the, say, of an interatomic size, is described very differently from this phonon description, because certainly it doesn't remember about many details of this microscopic Hamiltonian that we started with. In particular, it doesn't depend on the shape of the interatomic potential. But then at low energies, this description is very simple and universal. So in particular, so the wave equation, of course, is I mean, we could derive it macroscopically. So we didn't need to start with this microscopic Hamiltonian of the atomic chain. Any sound waves described by the very same equation. The only parameter that enters here is the sound, the speed of sound. So that's why any crystal is basically described by the same Hamiltonian, if you wish, by the same set of degrees of freedom. And many details of the microscopic dynamics are just hidden and not important at large distances. Anyway, so let's continue with this, with the derivation. So what we need to do is we just need to express the Hamiltonian in terms of this creation annihilation operators. Again, this is a matter of calculation, and I only give you the final result. So the Hamiltonian is equal to 1/2. And then integral over all wave vectors now it. It's a little bit different from the Hamiltonian for free particles because of this term. So the order of operators here is different from that one. But of course, we can use commutation relations of A and A dagger and write this as A K dagger A K plus their commutator. Uh, But unfortunately, the commutator doesn't seem to be well defined, because you see here k is the same. So if we use this formula, then what we get is the delta function evaluated at zero, which is infinity. So anyway, so at the end we get the expression that's the Hamiltonian of free particles. And then some C number contribution, which is just the ground state energy, the energy of a state without phonon without phonons excited. So this is the energy of the empty state. Okay, so this Hamiltonian describes free particles with the energy that depends on the wave number. Which linearly depends on the wave number. These particles are bosons because they satisfy their creation operators satisfy commutation relations. By the way, these emergent particles are usually called quasi-particles. So in condensed matter, this is a standard notion is that of a quasi-particle. This is something that doesn't act directly the underlying microscopic Hamiltonian, but in terms of which the low energy effective description is simple. The dispersion relation of phonons is the linear one, so the energy of a phonon is proportional to its momentum with the coefficient of proportionality, which is just the speed of sound. So this is because the momentum is given as usual by h bar times the wave number. And the energy is equal as follows from the Hamiltonian to h bar times cs times k. So this is, of course, expected. This is not unexpected because sound waves have linear dispersion relation. Okay, so let be. Now turn to the vacuum energy term, which is equal to, okay, so there will be this delta function evaluated at zero, and then the integral over all wave numbers of the absolute value of the wave number. So this integral is also divergent. So the ground state energy has the form of infinity times infinity. So apparently, it doesn't make much sense, right? So it's just infinite. And what does it really mean? Well, the right attitude is just to ignore this problem because the ground state energy per se doesn't make much physical sense. In fact, in deriving the phonon Hamiltonian, we already dropped a constant piece because so the potential between atoms at the minimum is some number, and we just forgot about this contribution of the interaction energy of atoms, we only kept the term that describes the deviations of atoms from the equilibrium. So we can just say that we don't care about this vacuum energy. The energies of phonon levels, if they are measured from the ground state energy, are finite. And basically, the physically interesting and measurable quantities are differences in energy levels, right? And these differences are finite. So we can simply forget about this term. This is certainly the right attitude, but since in quantum field theory one encounters this type of divergences all the time, let me spend a few minutes describing why we got these infinities and how should one understand them. Because after all, if we start from the original problem and don't do any approximations, so suppose we have n atoms interacting via some van der Waals potential, we could put this problem on a computer and it will produce some energy levels. And of course, the ground state energy will not be really infinite. So where did we make a mistake, and at which point we obtained this infinities? So first of all, they are of very different nature. So the delta function is so here the divergence arises at small momenta. So this is the divergence at k equals zero. So small momenta correspond to large distances. So equivalently, this is the this divergence is associated with large distances. So in quantum field theory, typically the divergences that arise at small momenta are called infrared divergences. So this is an example of an infrared divergence. On the other hand, the integral behaves well at 0k, but diverges at k equals infinity. So this is divergent at k equal infinity, which corresponds to small distances. And in quantum field theory, this is typically called UV divergence, ultraviolet divergence. So these terms infrared and ultraviolet, they come from spectroscopy, so field theory grew up from nuclear physics, and there it's really was denoted different ranges of frequencies, and so infrared means low frequencies and ultraviolet high frequencies. Anyway, so this is just a terminology. So let us try to understand why do these divergences arise. So since they have very different physical origin, let's treat them separately because they are really unrelated to one another. Yes? Just because its argument is zero. So it's...
Wasn't it a difference of k minus k?
Yes, this was a difference, but yeah, this means that was the difference. Sure, yes, so this was, it arose because, the difference between k and another k was really zero. So the difference in moment is zero. Yeah, let's write delta k if you wish.
But this means that this delta diverges at any value of k.
At any value of k. Well, it's a delta function. We've got it evaluated exactly at zero. So at zero, the delta function has an infinite peak. So it's
an infinite. No, I mean like at any value of k, delta k minus k will diverge.
At any value of k. Yeah, sure. So. Yeah, one may wonder what matters, k or delta k. I'll try to argue that delta k is what matters. So really, this is really an effect of large distances and small momentum. So large distances. So the way to deal with the divergences is to somehow, so the original problem as we formulated it was finite. So we need just to go one step back and see what approximation was wrong, in a sense. Yes?
But we have the delta function inside the k integral. So why did it come out?
It doesn't depend on k, right? So it can take it out.
Oh, isn't it the delta function? I thought that was a problem.
It's delta of k minus k.
Yeah.
Right, so it's delta of 0, independently of k. Okay, so you just need to understand where this divergence comes from. And so we need to regularize the problem in a certain way. So if we go to some previous step, namely we need to make our system finite in its spatial extent, right? So since this divergence comes from large distances, presumably it arose because we considered an infinite atomic chain, and if we make the atomic chain finite, then it should disappear. So let's try to check if this works. So to make the atomic chain finite, we just impose periodic boundary conditions. So instead of atomic chain of infinite lengths, you consider a chain of lengths L. So all our variables are then periodic functions of L. And then we can repeat the same steps. So what we do is we define the same creation and annihilation operators. But you see that they are defined as Fourier integrals. And if you have a periodic system, then the result of imposing periodic boundary conditions is that Fourier modes become discrete, and instead of Fourier integrals, we have sums. So the mode numbers get quantized. So waves propagating on a periodic, so in a periodic system, we can only have standing waves with certain mode numbers. So K should be equal to 2 pi L divided by L, where L is an integer. Then oscillators will be now labeled by an integer L instead of continuous wave number. And so when we'll compute their commutation relations, in the right-hand side, instead of the delta function, we'll have the Kronecker delta. So originally, this delta function arises because we need to take an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of e to the minus I x k minus k prime. So that gives you the delta function. Now, this integral is regulated. So it runs from 0 to L instead of minus infinity to plus infinity. So what we'll have is minus 2 pi I x L minus L prime divided by big L. And this is equal to L times Kronecker delta. Okay, so instead of the delta function, we will have Kronecker deltas multiplied by some factor that depends on L. In particular, the divergent term in the energy comes from the delta with the zero argument. And now you see that when we take the same mode numbers, this integral is still finite, but is proportional to L. So what we should do is we should replace delta of 0 effectively will be replaced by L divided by 2 pi. So this falls simply by comparing these two integrals, right? So they should be, I mean, this integral is replaced by that. And this integral is ill-defined when k is equal to k prime. But we can understand that this really comes from the limit of L going to infinity. And so the right way to deal with this delta function is to replace it by, OK, L divided by 2 pi. So this means that this delta function is simply a substitute for the total length of the atomic chain. So the vacuum energy is proportional to this length. which is only to be expected because the ground state energy is an extensive quantity. So the better behaved quantity is the energy density. So if we define the energy density, then it stays finite in the thermodynamic limit. And let's see. So to get rid of this infrared divergence, we just need to consider correctly defined quantity. So we should concentrate on the energy density, and then it is fine. But then this integral is still divergent at large momenta. So here I replaced k by p by rescaling with the h bar.
Again, we can understand the origin of it. So the reason why it arises is that at some point we made an approximation forgetting about the structure of that empty chain. So we replaced the discrete chain by some continuum model, so the wave equation. And this, of course, changes physics at very, very small wave numbers of order of one of the atomic chains. So in particular, in the original model, the distances could not be large, could not be smaller than the lattice spacing. Which by uncertainty relation means that the momenta must be smaller than, r divided by. So, or I can erase the question. So the momenta cannot be. There is a certain cutoff on the momenta, just the physics cutoff, that arises because the original system was discrete. And you see, this is precisely the region of momenta where the integral diverges. So there is a physical cutoff on the upper boundary of momenta. And so we should really integrate up to the moment of this order of magnitude. And not really to infinity. So, we can actually, for this particular case, in this simple atomic chain model, we can go back and solve the system before taking the continuum limit. So because the Hamiltonian is quadratic, and this is essentially a set of oscillators, so we can diagonalize it by Fourier transform. But this Fourier transform will be discrete. So if our L, if we make L finite, which is to say x is periodic, then the wave number is quantized. So this becomes discrete.
Now, on the other hand, if we make x discrete, then the momentum will become periodic. So in the original model, if you were to solve it exactly, again, I skipped the derivation, but the exact lattice dispersion relation is that epsilon of p is equal to 2 h bar speed of sound divided by a times absolute value of the sine a p divided by 2 h bar. So if a goes to 0, then we can expand the sine, and so we're returned back to the linear dispersion relation of the sound waves. Yes?
Why is it that when we make all finite, we need to impose periodic time conditions? I can't have any.
No, not necessarily. But if you do, then okay. The momentum immediately becomes discrete.
Okay. So it works even if you don't, but it's more.
Sorry?
So this works even if you don't make it periodic, but it's more dynamical.
Yeah, yes, of course, but the modes that will be different. We will have sines and sine modes instead of exponents. It will be depends on the boundary conditions. But, anyway, this was just to illustrate this point, so that if you make x discrete, then momentum space becomes periodic. Okay, but so what it really means to take A to 0, A is dimensionful quantity. So by taking it to 0, we really take to 0 the product A times P divided by H. So this means that A P over H bar is much smaller than 1. So so this is the really the approximation that we have made when we consider our continuous model of photons. And so the real dispersion curve of photons will be somewhat different. So if we plot epsilon as a function of p, then the dispersion of sound waves is just a linear function, right? Whereas the lattice phonons have, first of all, they have periodic momentum. So we can only confine, so we can confine P to the single Brillouin zone up to P A divided by H bar, and then minus of that. Should be p h bar divided by So real curve of lattice phonons doesn't deviate much for long wavelengths or small momenta phonons. And then at lattice scales, it starts to curve a little bit, so it's not linear anymore. And also, there is a fundamental cutoff on the momentum. So we really have to take into account only phonon states, phonon levels that lie here in between the boundaries of the Brillouin zone. Actually, it doesn't have boundaries. You should think of this as a circle. So these points and this are periodically identified. So anyway, the vacuum energy density in the lattice model should be calculated as 1/2 and then integral over the Brillouin zone. Of, well, the lattice phonon energy, h bar cs divided by a times sine ap divided by 2 h bar. So if one does the integral, this is 2p, 2 h bar cs divided by p a squared. So you see it diverges in the limit where we when we take a to infinity. It is quadratically divergent in this lattice, in the lattice spacing. So it's not surprising that in the model where we from the beginning took the limit of a going to 0, we got infinity. So to conclude, really, as expected in this model, there are no divergences. And the reason that they arise is just because we made certain approximations. And so in principle, we could have guessed that, that the answer for the energy density should be like that. Because, okay, so the in the continuum model, we had an integral of the linear dispersion relation. And so we know that it's only valid up to momenta of order of h bar divided by a. So there is some cutoff in this integral at this sort of moment. And so if you cut off it at some scale, you would probably not be able to get the correct constant here to divide it by pi. But the order of magnitude would be right. So, and then the infrared divergence is simply arose because we computed the extensive quantity. The physical energy density is finite in the thermodynamic limit. Now, now, what should we learn from this calculation? Well, first of all, that the effective description in terms of phonons is to some extent incomplete. If you want to compute certain quantities like the ground state energy density, we would get results that have no sense. It's divergent integrals. But even without knowing the details of the microscopic physics, we could have estimated the order of magnitude of these divergent integrals. And moreover, many quantities, like the levels of low-lying phonons, their spectrum, et cetera, could be computed within this approximate model where we get rid of all the details of the underlying atomic chain. So the attitude is, correct attitude is just to concentrate on these calculable finite quantities. And as soon as we have a divergence, this means that we simply cannot calculate this quantity in the continuum, in the continuum limit. And we should somehow either subtract this divergence, so we can, by say, measuring all energy levels with respect to the ground state energy, or understand its microscopic origin. So anyway, in many cases, we can even get rid of this sort of hide these divergences in some phenological parameters by imposing certain physical consistency principles. So let me, as an illustration, talk about thermodynamics of lattice vibrations within the model that was proposed by Debye many, many years ago. It was, the Debye model was proposed even before quantum mechanics. But the ideas behind it are very important in, well, in quantum field theory in particular. So suppose that we consider some real crystal in three-dimensional lattice with many sorts of atoms and complicated lattice structure, for which we cannot really write down microscopic Hamiltonian, or it will be very, very complicated. On the other hand, we know that sufficiently low energies or large momenta, the vibrations of the lattice are described by sound waves, because the wave equation is universal. And the only parameter that will enter this low energy description will be the speed of sound. And the speed of sound is by itself is a macroscopic parameter. So the square of the speed of sound is the derivative of, is it basically determined by compressibility adiabatic compressibility of the material. So this is a macroscopic parameter. Yes.
And the density.
Yes, this is the pressure and the So in principle, knowing the equation of state, we know the speed of sound, or it can be measured directly. So then we know how to quantize the wave equation. So we will have so we know that the low-lying spectrum of excitations will be just phonons with the linear dispersion relation. And in a three-dimensional crystal, there will be, so a phonon will have three polarizations because the displacement vector is a vector, so it has three components. Okay, so then right, so so in principle, the phonons will have some dispersion relation, which at low momentum will be linear. Just from the wave equation, we can deduce that the dispersion relation of a low energy phonon is linear in its momentum. And then at scales of order of inverse lattice spacing, the spectrum will start to get distorted in a way that depends on the structure of the elementary cell, et cetera, et cetera. So the spectrum will become complicated. But we may expect that certain, the behavior, this is thermodynamic of phonons, will be somewhat insensitive to these details of microscopic physics. And so this is the idea behind the Debye model. So his model starts with the assumption. So it's a very crude model of crystal vibration. So he said the following. So let's model this cutoff on the energy in the following way. So we say that all phonons up to certain energy have this linear dispersion relation. And beyond this cutoff energy, there is nothing. So there are no phonon states. So there is in the momentum space, so this is space of momenta, we draw a sphere of radius P max. And so inside this sphere, we assume that we can approximate phonons by their continuous dispersion relation. And outside, we say that there are no states. So what can we compute in this model? For instance, we can compute the energy density. Let me see. So So first, before we do any computation, let's try to figure out what is this maximal momentum. So we know that E max is of order of h bar divided by a, where a is the lattice spacing. But then imposing some consistency, macroscopic consistency conditions, we can figure out what it is in terms of the phenomenological thermodynamic parameters. So namely, we say that the total number of degrees of freedom remains the same. So we know that the crystal in total has n atoms. So each atom has 3 degrees of freedom. So we can match the number of degrees of freedom in the original macroscopic model, which is 3n. And then here we can just compute the number of phonon levels inside this ball. So which would be equal to d3p divided by 2 pi h bar. So by Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization tells you that there is exactly one level per the cell in the per the cell in the phase space of volume 2 pi h. So if you multiply the volume of the spatial volume of the crystal by the volume of this Debye sphere in momentum space. Yes. Yes. And also we should multiply by 3 because each phonon has 3 polarizations. So then we can, well, evaluate the volume of the sphere, and what we get is V. Lambda cubed divided by 2p squared h cubed, and then speed of sound cubed. So this lambda is called the Debye energy. And this is basically the radius of the sphere. So E max is equal to Debye energy divided by the speed of sound. So the integral here is taken by the sphere of radius lambda divided by Cs. So from this equation, we conclude that the Debye energy is equal to 6 pi squared h cubed, speed of sound cubed, n divided by v to 1/3. And so again, you see that we managed to express this cutoff scale through, basically macroscopic parameters. So the density of the number density of atoms and the speed of sound. So and then we can compute the the energy of lattice vibrations by integrating the Bose distribution of phonons. So this cannot be expressed in terms of elementary functions, but we can write it as 3n k Boltzmann t times some function of the dimensionless ratio of Debye energy to thermal energy. And so this D is defined as has an integral representation. So this is sometimes called the Debye function. So from here, one can compute the heat capacity. And heat capacity is something that can be easily measured. So this will be given by the Debye function and its derivative. So this is some sort of phenomenological theory of heat capacity. And you can see that in the two limiting cases, this function, I mean, we get the expected answer. So if the temperature is small, Then the heat capacity is given by Stefan-Boltzmann formula. So it's proportional to lambda cube in particular. And if the temperature is very high, then the heat capacity is equal to 3N times K Boltzmann. And what is this? Well, this is just the heat capacity of N atoms that simply not interact with each other. So at high temperatures, it doesn't matter that they make a crystal. And the reason that we got this correct match in the high temperature behavior is that we imposed this match of the degrees of freedom when we determine the Debye energy. So all in all, the heat capacity curve would look like that. So the heat capacity of, so the Stefan-Boltzmann law is some cubic curve, right? And it correctly describes the heat capacity at low temperatures. And so the Debye model predicts the deviations from this curve. So the in the Debye model, the heat capacity will interpolate between this cubic heat capacity of free Fonod gas, and then it will saturate on the heat capacity of free atoms. And this is a reasonable approximation for the majority of solids at sufficiently high temperatures. So when electrons of conductance electrons are not important. Anyway, so the conclusion is that by imposing certain consistency conditions, we can understand even the, I mean, how to extract the physics even at short distances where, strictly speaking, our approximation doesn't work. So you see that this limit for the modes that are important have momentum of order of square root, well, of order of temperature, or energies of order of temperature, and those we describe completely randomly, right? So this is a very crude, Debye model is a very crude approximation to a real crystal. But nevertheless, since we imposed the correct match of the degrees of freedom, we got some reasonable result. So I will stop here. Thank you.